Hey diehards, welcome back to Dialogue, or welcome to the show if it is your first time listening. So happy you're here to listen to Dialogue, a true crime conversation. I'm your host, Rebecca Sebastian, and today is episode 54, and my guest is so cool. I'm like just busting at the seams to introduce you to her and her to you. Her name is Charlotte Lang, and she is a retired FBI agent. And if you've watched Netflix's new three-part docuseries called Fear City, you would have seen her appearance in the third and final part of that documentary. If you haven't yet seen it and you're interested in the mob and the mafia and that aspect of true crime realm, go watch it. It's really good. I got an advanced screener, so I watched it on my vacation a couple weeks ago, and I got to speak to Agent Charlotte Lang. And not only do I get to hear about her involvement in the takedown of the highest mob bosses called the Commission, I got to hear about her experience as a female FBI agent at a time when there were so few. I mean, literally like a handful. So it wasn't exactly a warm and welcoming culture, but she really proved herself and went on to become supervisor, and she advanced and advanced, retired early, and she's just a firecracker and brilliant. But her journey to the FBI was kind of unconventional. And you know I love hearing people's career paths and how they get where they are. So this one just has everything that I love. And I'm so grateful for Charlotte Lang's work and her service, and also for her time speaking with me. So please, if you haven't watched Fear City, do it. I'd love to hear what you think about it, and enjoy this episode. Whether you watched it or not, you're gonna love hearing her recount her time in 1984 New York City, becoming part of a huge mafia takedown and her journey to the FBI. It's just one amazing story after the other, including her sitting in a restaurant next to Fat Tony as a spy, essentially trying to get information and hear what he was talking about. So just incredible. I mean, my jaw was on the ground half the interview. Enjoy. As always, if you liked this podcast and this episode, share it with a friend, leave a rating and review, follow me on social media at Dialogue Pod, and you can find links to the documentary, to my website, to merch, and to my social media in the show notes wherever you are listening to this now. Thank you, and let's kill the small talk. Right, Charlotte, thank you so much for being on Dialogue, a true crime conversation. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So I'm excited to speak with you. I finished and really enjoyed the Netflix three-part series, Fear City. And I guess, honestly, if I had just one suggestion or feedback for the documentary, it would be, I think you could have had a little more part of the story. I would have loved to have learned more about you through the documentary. So that's why I'm especially thrilled you're on Dialogue, because I have more questions for you. I didn't get quite enough of your story.
Well, you know what happened that morning? The driver who was supposed to pick me up was at the wrong location, and they kept emphasizing to me how important it was to be on time, because they had rented this pizza parlor for just a couple of hours. So I was late getting there because I couldn't find the guy. Finally, I tracked him down. He was on the other side of where the hotel was. So I arrived late, and they came running out of the pizza parlor to grab me and, you know, mic me up and let's get going. And they were all upset because there was so much street noise between garbage trucks backing up. And when Sam would ask me a question, it just seemed like every time I went to respond, the sound man would jump up because there was just too much noise. And a lot of times, I mean, I didn't even remember what I said. It's like, well, where do you want to start? I don't even remember what I said. So I thought to myself, I'm probably only going to be on the show for like 5 minutes at the most, because it was just so noisy in the location.
Oh my gosh, that's a tough way to start. Were you frazzled, or did you feel like you got in and you got grounded and you know, were able to feel good?
Right, right. But like I said, it was just kind of a crazy morning. I was where I was supposed to be. I was there like 10, 15 minutes early, and the driver, he took a long way to get over to Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I don't know whether there was traffic or construction. So I was there much, much later than what they were expecting.
It happens, right? I mean, and of course, everything would go wrong with the driver. That's always the case when you have to be somewhere and it's time sensitive. Well, mm-hmm. I'll do some background. So you are one of the FBI agents brought in to this case in 1984 in New York City that was really about bringing down the high-level mob bosses in New York City. But before we get to that part of the story, I'd really love to hear how you became an FBI agent, what your path to that station in life was.
Well, at the time I was living, before I came into the Bureau, I started out in education, and I was a teacher and a school administrator. And then I took a job with IBM, and I was living just right off the Yale University campus in New Haven. And I was going to a conference out in Chicago. And I was just killing time in the morning, and I had the local newspaper, and there was an article in there about a woman who was a nurse at Yale New Haven University Hospital. And she had become an FBI agent. So I'm just kind of like reading it, and I thought that's kind of exciting because I was dating a man who was like 16 years older than me who worked for IBM. And I was having like a bad sales month, and you know, we're going out on a Saturday night, and I was feeling depressed and everything like that. And he kept on saying, you know, buck up, you know, don't let it bring you down. What we do isn't that important. We're just selling a product. And if they don't buy it from us, they're going to buy it from somebody else. It's just not important. And I thought to myself, well, why should I be in a job where what I'm doing is not important? So when I read that article and there was the name of an FBI agent, I thought, because I was going to Chicago for a week, I just took a resume, no cover letter or anything. I was on my way to the airport, and I just dropped it in the mailbox. And when I came back, of course, this is back when there weren't cell phones or anything, I had a couple phone messages on my desk. And my group secretary said to me, she said, Charlotte, I hope you aren't in some sort of trouble, but this FBI agent has called twice, and I told him you would be back today. So I called Max, and interesting enough, he had worked for IBM, and he was from Chicago. So he said, why don't you come in, and we'll talk. So I went in and had, you know, the talk with him. Went through the, you know, it's a long procedure of what you go through, because they do background investigation and talk to neighbors every place where you've lived, and, you know, aptitude tests. You go before a panel where questioned by three agents. And so I was offered a position, and I thought, well, I'll give it a go, and I'm glad I did. It was my third and my last career.
My jaw is on the floor. Is this a typical story? I feel like, you know, you've been in the FBI now. You've certainly met many agents and colleagues. This seems like a non-conventional way to enter the FBI. Am I wrong?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because when I went to down to Quantico, I went down to Quantico in October of 81, and Reagan was president. There were some budget issues. We were the only training class down there in this huge facility, and usually there's a new class coming in every 2 weeks. And we started out as a group of 30, and we were down to 27 very quickly because they want to wash out people who aren't going to make it initially instead of spending the government's money on them. And we were probably, the teachers and instructors would come in and look at us because we were a very mature-looking group because to become an agent then, you had to be at least 25. And if you were in law school, they took you right out of law school. I had an undergraduate and a master's degree and some, you know, classes for a PhD whenever I applied. So I met that criteria. So we had people that I think the average age in our class was probably the low 30s. We had prosecutors. We had an Army major or an Air Force major. We had teachers. We had a chemist from Tufts University. It was just kind of, we all had that same thing that we wanted to do something exciting and fun because we already had careers doing something else. And we all chose, for whatever reason, to apply to the FBI. And you spend 4 months locked up down there in Quantico, so you get to know everyone pretty well.
Wow, that's amazing. Did you know what sort of where you'd be specializing or under what department you'd be helping? I mean, there's so many ways to be an FBI agent. Did you get to decide that, or is that assigned to you?
No, that's basically, they call it the needs of the Bureau. And they told us on the very first day when we were up at FBI headquarters, you know, you have been selected. Where you go is going to be based on the needs of the Bureau. So if you think that when you're done going through training school that you're going to go back home, because they told us prior that you will go back to the office where you came in for about 6 to 8 months, and then you will go to a small, medium-sized office for 2 to 4 years, and then you will go on to a top 10 office. So you're looking at a couple of moves just, you know, right there. And they basically said, if you don't agree with this program, leave now, because that's what you're going to do. So what happened was I went back to New Haven, and I spent 30 days in New Haven, but Bridgeport is really where all the action is in Connecticut relative to crime.
Sure.
And the supervisor of that particular office came up to me, and he said, you know what, I'm going to get you down to Bridgeport, because you'll be able to, instead of being on a white-collar squad, working bank frauds and embezzlements and stuff, and, you know, cases that have paper trails, you need to come to Bridgeport because you'll work everything. And I said, well, you know, wherever you want me to go, I'll go. Well, next thing I know, I was in Bridgeport, and it was a wonderful learning experience. So, of course, the time came to go to that small office, and I was sent to San Antonio. And when I was in Bridgeport, I was the only woman down there, so I was tapped to do a lot of things. And when I went to San Antonio, I was the only woman in the division. And San Antonio division encompasses the whole south part of Texas.
Wow.
So it's a huge territory with resident agencies down in McAllen and Brownsville, Waco, I mean, various offices. So I got to do a lot of cameo undercover experiences, even though I was assigned to white collar. I did a lot of bank robberies. The number two man in charge of the division basically said to me, I'm going to let you experience as much as you possibly can. So by the time you get to a large office, you'll be well-rounded. Well, what happened was I was supposed to be there for 2 to 4 years. And I always wanted to work in New York City ever since I was a kid, and we took a trip to New York. So there was a teletype that came out, because this was in 1983, at the beginning of 83. And New York had a record number of agents resign because of the cost of living. Reagan was president. Wall Street was booming. Properties were appreciating in New Jersey, New York, just a tremendous amount. And some agents were quitting to take better jobs, or they were going home, basically, what they were doing. So they were asking for volunteers to come to New York. And I knew full well that the amount I was making in San Antonio, I was going to be paid the same amount in New York, but I still raised my hand.
Oh, my gosh.
So what happened was, the head of the San Antonio division, he had been an agent in New York before going to San Antonio. And it was kind of a unique experience, because you just wait to see where they're going to assign you. And he said to me, he said, what would you like to work? And I said, well, gee, I don't know. I said, I kind of feel like I've done so many different things, but I can't say that I have a preference. So he said, okay, well, I'll call the boss and, you know, see where they want to put you. So he told me a couple days later that I was on the phone, and he slipped me a note, and he said I was going to be working organized crime whenever I got up to New York. So that's how I ended up getting that assignment.
Wow. So you show up in New York for this 1984 case that they're trying to crack. They're trying to indict 5 major families. I mean, do you feel ready for that? Are you overwhelmed? Are you scared?
That was when I got there in 83. I got there in the summer of 80. I got there in August of 83. And Giuliani had gotten to the United States Attorney's Office in June. So he had just been the United States Attorney for 2 years when I arrived. okay. And of course, he's coming in with his big ideas and everything like that, you know, lots of publicity and making statements to the press that he's going to bring the mob down and everything. And it was kind of interesting because there was an agent in San Antonio who was on my squad, and he was transferred to New York a few months before me. And he called me, and he saw I was coming to New York, and he wanted me to buy a gun. And this is what you could do. I could walk into a gun store in Texas and buy a .357 Magnum, and I could take it to him in New York.
Sure.
So he wanted me to bring him this gun. And he said, "Do you know what you're working?" And I said, "Yeah, supposedly I'm going to be working organized crime." And there was kind of like dead silence. And Lee was an accountant, and he was on a white-collar squad. And he said, "Well, the only thing I can tell you about those guys is it seems like they do a lot of work, but nobody goes to jail." And I thought, well, good grief. So what had happened was the big push when I got there is when the big push was basically beginning in with, you know, the arrival of Rudy and, you know, a couple of key players in the FBI that and basically coming to the realization that we got to work these cases different. We have to have a squad for each family. We have to do this. We have to do that. So I got there when the push was going on. And so what was basically happening is, because I said to Pat, when we went over to have the first meeting about this commission case that Rudy wanted, on top of all the family cases that were going on, because wires were being, at that time, wires were being working, were being worked, excuse me, on the Gambino family. And then we finally got up on the Lucchese family with putting the Mike in the Jaguar. And, of course, the great work that John Joyce and his squad did on the Colombo family with the Casastorta wire and the wire on Ralph Scopo. And then when I got there, they had just gotten the authorization to put the wire in Fat Tony's social club up in East Harlem.
Wow.
So basically, when Pat and I, when we went over to have this meeting at the United States Attorney's Office, and Rudy's talking about this, you know, the way you kill the snake, you cut the head off, and he's going on and on about the commission case and everything. So we walked out of the office, and we were walking across the plaza to go back, and I said to Pat, because I had no organized crime experience at this particular time, and we stopped for a red light, and I remember turning to him and saying, "Pat," I said, "you know, these are such dangerous people. Who would we ever get to testify against these people?"
Right.
And he turned to me and he said, "Oh, I'm not worried about witnesses." He said, "I'm worried about predicates." Now, do you know what a predicate is?
I don't. In this context, no.
No, I didn't either.
Well, that makes me feel better.
Like this. I know. He said, "I'm worried about the predicates." And what that is under the RICO statute, what you have to do is you have to show that there's a criminal enterprise and that these people are associated in fact. It just has to be two or more people that are associated in fact. They don't have to have an actual membership. They have an association, okay? So you can put them together based on telephone calls, based on photos, based on electronic surveillance. And what you have to do is they have to commit at least two predicate acts, that is, two crimes that support that. That's a minimum, okay, that support the conspiracy. So what you do is it can be murder. There are federal crimes and there are state crimes that can be used. And as long as you can prove that they have proved at least two, because with the extortion in the construction industry, we had 14 predicate acts. So, and you're looking at 20 years for each of those acts.
Wow.
So let's say you have somebody like Bruno Indelicato, who was one of the killers of Carmine Galante and his two associates. Okay, he's found guilty of the RICO conspiracy, okay, because he's carrying out a mob hit for the commission. That's 20 years. What were his two predicate acts? Well, they're actually three, because he was involved in the shooting of three people. So he was looking at 80 years with no parole.
Got it.
So that's kind of like how the RICO statute works.
Got it. Okay, and I want to bookmark and just pause here and define the RICO Act for people who haven't watched yet or aren't familiar with that. I have it in front of me, the Racketeer, Influenced, and Corrupt Organizations Act. So this was a federal law passed. And when did this come about? In the 70s, or was this just right before all this?
Yes, this was like an omnibus crime act that was like 1970.
Okay.
And when Blakely wrote it, he was a professor up at Cornell University. It was on the books, but it's like nobody could quite figure out how to use it. And Rudy, coming up from Maine DOJ, he had it in his mind that he knew how we could use this particular federal statute. And the whole approach became Jim Kossler, who was a teacher, he basically taught classes on RICO. This is how we're going to work these cases, which, you know, that's kind of unheard of when you're in the field that you're getting these classes. But he called it the enterprise theory of investigation. And that's how we were going to work these particular cases.
Okay, so it was an entire new strategy. It was a new thought, new school of thought approach on how to take these guys down. And you had to do it by the book and follow these certain ways, or you were done, right? You would compromise the whole investigation, and you might not end up with any arrests or convictions. So it had to be done.
Well, I mean, the thing that's, you know, in the past, a soldier would be prosecuted for maybe loan sharking or gambling or bookkeeping or something like that. And he always kicked his money up, okay? And
sure.
Then the boss would take a cut, the underboss would take a cut, and then he would get what was left. So, but the soldier would go to jail, but all the people above didn't. And what was interesting about this particular case, that we were able to prove, like Carmine Persico was the boss of the family, of the Colombo family at that time. During the entire investigation, for the first part of it, he was hiding out in the attic of a cousin's house. And the cousin's husband got like fed up with Carmine and turned him in. So, you know, we were able to arrest him, and then he was sitting in jail. And the whole time during the investigation, he was still running. We were able to prove that he was still running the family through his underboss, which was Jerry Langella. And every time there was a key event that would occur, we could get the prison records that showed that Langella went up to see Carmine, like prior, like maybe the day before or 2 days before. So the beauty of this is all these crimes committed by the underlings are being done at the direction of a boss and an underboss. And if you can tie them in, they're implicated, even though they didn't carry out the crimes. They ordered them. So this was like a whole, you know, new, beautiful approach for working these cases.
Yeah, you know, it feels comparable. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'd like your thought on this, too, to the approach on drug dealing, right? These low-level street dealers are not really the biggest problem. They're getting violations in New York City, even now, all the time, going to jail, posting bail, you know, in and out of court all the time, but it's the people making the bigger decisions who are wielding all the money and all the power that you're really trying to take down, to eradicate, or at least, you know, minimize the damage of the bigger problem, right?
Right. And another thing that we had to overcome, you have to see it in the context of what was the climate. Well, New York, as portrayed in the series, it was a rough town, to say the least, into the 70s and going into the 80s. And all these wise guys would be arrested and be prosecuted and get, you know, like 3 or 4 years, and they're back on the street. But their number one defense, and the defense that all the defense attorneys used, was, there is no such thing as the La Cosa Nostra. There is no such thing as the mafia. This is a government conspiracy. These are a bunch of Italians sitting in a social club enjoying themselves. So we basically had to overcome that to prove, yes, this is a secret organization that exists. And one of the things that happened was during this time, old Joe Bonanno, the Bonanno family, wrote a book. And in the book, there was a chapter. I remember I went to a bookstore to pick it up. And there was a chapter, I think it was chapter 6, that he got in trouble with the commission in New York, and he fled and he fled to Arizona. So he's basically describing about this entity, about these, because you have five families operating in this large geographical area, that the bosses had to coordinate things.
Right.
So we actually subpoenaed the old man to come to New York to testify, but he feigned a heart condition in 1957 when he was arrested at Appalachian, New York.
Yeah.
And he was feigning the same heart condition that he couldn't testify to the grand jury. So Rudy said, well, you know what? We're going out there. And we did. We all went to Tucson, even the judge and two of his clerks, Pat and I, couple of the prosecutors, and we did, of course, Rudy took some press guys with him, too. And we had this medical competency hearing to see whether he was fit to travel to testify. And I had developed a rapport with this cardiologist at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. We even took him out to examine the old man. And, of course, he found him fit to travel and to testify. So what Judge Owens did was he held him in contempt for his refusal. He's refusing to testify via being subpoenaed by the federal grand jury. And Rudy had arranged for the marshals, and they had a plane and the marshals just waiting. So as soon as Owens said, you know, you're going to jail for contempt, they scooped him up and they flew him off to the Springfield Medical Facility in the prison in Springfield, Missouri. And that was the only time he ever went to jail in his whole career.
Wow.
And he didn't get out until the day after the verdicts came in, because he still had the opportunity to testify, but of course he wasn't going to do that. So we had these people that we knew were all these defense attorneys that were going to basically argue there's no such thing as the La Cosa Nostra. But then we had Joe Pistone, who was the agent that was undercover in the Bonanno family for 6 years. And then our Cleveland office had Angelo Leonardo was the boss of the Cleveland family. And he was in jail for the rest of his life on a drug trafficking case. And there was an agent in Cleveland that worked the case and would go and visit him, you know, how you doing, Ange, and everything like that. And he convinced Ange to cooperate with us. So basically the FBI scooped him up. So we had him for several years in our position, in our possession. And Angelo, his family, the Cleveland family, always reported to the Genovese family in New York. So he would meet with Fat Tony. He knew the bosses of the five families. So he also testified about the existence of this commission, because we had to prove to the jury that there actually was such a thing as the mafia, and before we could really do anything. So that was one of our first things before we got into the witnesses and the particularly the tapes. The Title III, the electronic surveillance, they were the wires and the conversations that we had, they were like little gold mines that we used.
So what do you think the resistance was to people believing there was such a thing as the mafia? Was it because they were so effective at what they did? Was it because they were so connected to all these different parts of industry that people accepted it or were even maybe benefiting from it, or they're too scared? Like, why the resistance to believe that this is real?
Well, you know, it was almost like a cultural thing. I mean, it was so ingrained in New York City that you had to pay to play is the way it was. And, you know, when these people would get jammed up, because it was a secret society, and it was kind of like fodder for defense attorneys. They had to come up with something in order to defend their clients. And the easiest thing to do is say, this is a government conspiracy. There's no such thing as an organization like this.
Okay.
And it worked in many cases. It worked.
Yeah. So we've referenced it many times, but we're using this term, the commission, which is this meeting of the highest level bosses from five different families. So it's as though these five different families competing, you might say, kind of come together, the top guys, to form this commission, right? And that's exactly who you're targeting.
Right. Well, you know, because what was going on is because each of the squads was like kind of working a family case. And there was all this overlap because they were dividing up profits, like particularly with Fat Tony and Paul Castellano. And then you and in the Colombo family, having Ralph Piscopo head of the concrete union workers. When you think of it, if you're going to build a building in New York, what's the first ingredient do you need? Cement.
Yep.
Okay. And Scopo has his control of the workers that finish the cement. And Castellano and Fat Tony control the Teamsters Union. You don't get cement unless the Teamsters drive the trucks to the site.
Right.
So this was like a golden opportunity for the mob because they controlled so many aspects of so many industries. And everybody just kind of paid their fair share just to get to work, to do the business.
Right.
Is really, and I mean, when you look at the rubouts and, you know, the shootings that were taking place in the mob over decades, there's a terrible fear factor here. So people really have to basically participate if they want to stay in business.
Yeah.
They can close a business. They were able to close businesses down, basically.
Right. They wielded so much power.
Yes.
So there's kind of an allusion to the Trump building, you know, that's part of the documentary. And it must have been, you know, this is like the heyday for Trump and his real estate endeavors in New York City. But it doesn't go too much into it. It isn't like a secondary plot or anything, but it definitely got me wondering about his role, his organization's role, and the mafia. I mean, how likely, if you don't have to divulge specifically, if you know or don't know, I don't know, would it be that they would have had to be encountering the mob to do their real estate work?
Oh, any builder would most likely be paying. I mean, we were able to identify the concrete companies based upon the information that was coming out of the Colombo family wire, where they were meant the names of the actual concrete companies that anything over $2 million, they had to start kicking any job over $2 million, they had to start kicking back money to the mob. And I just know that all that work that was done on those companies, I don't know whether Trump's name ever came up.
Okay.
I mean, I personally don't know that. I prepared probably hundreds of conversations that we were going to use in court. I never heard his name on the tapes that I did, but that doesn't mean he wasn't. I know they were on some tapes, but I have no knowledge of them or what they were about.
Got it. But for real estate development as an industry, there would have been some connection.
Yes.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Most definitely.
Very interesting. So on a personal level, how are you handling this and what is the timeline from arriving in New York, starting, you know, through completion? And how are you handling it? Are you scared? Do you ever have any close calls? Talk about the experience just as one of few women in the agency. I would just love to hear your personal experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I got there in August of 83 and, I'm trying to think. I don't remember whenever we first. One thing was we were a brand new squad. DeVecchio was the supervisor. Pat Marshall was those two were the two guys that were really knowledgeable of organized crime, and we were all being transferred in. You know, everybody was like me. They did their 2 to 4 years at a small office, and now they're doing a top 10 office.
Okay.
And not everybody was coming at the same time. So I pretty much got, when I got there, Kostler said to me, we're not going to put the squad together probably for another 6 weeks, so I'm going to put you on the Genovese squad, and you can transcribe some of the wires that we have running, which was quite an experience for somebody, particularly with an education background, having a headset on and listening to 8 mob guys sitting around a table and cursing and swearing.
Oh, my gosh.
And being crude and rude, to say the least, but that, you know, you kind of get into the flow of it and basically doing it. And then another thing was, because there were so few women, I mean, at that time, there were only 6,400 agents in the FBI. And I know there's like 4 or 5 times that now.
Oh, wow.
But there were only 6,400 agents. And in New York alone, there were 1,200 agents. And most of the women were not working criminal. They were on another floor working FCI, Foreign Counterintelligence.
Oh.
So when I got there, There were two women already on the Genevieve squad, you know, really exceptional agents doing, you know, really good work. So it was nice to be exposed to them and to be around them. But what would happen is, because there were so few women, that we would be caught up and tapped to go on big arrest, where they would be putting, like, we're arresting 20 people tomorrow and you're on one of the teams, one of the arrest teams. And then there were instances, one in particular that sticks out is we had source information that Fat Tony and Paul Castellano were going to be having lunch. So, you know, this is a great opportunity because you can photograph them going in, you can get them photographed coming out. So there was a woman on the Columbo squad. So I think there were two on the Columbo squad. So there were five of us. Okay, five women. And so Corinne was pregnant. And, you know, nobody pays any attention to a pregnant woman. So they came up with the plan that Corinne and I would go into this restaurant and try to sit at a table as close to Fat Tony and Paul Castellano as we could. To try to overhear what they were saying.
Yeah.
And it was a very upscale restaurant, you know, with all the waiters wearing tuxedos, but it was very small and intimate. There weren't that many tables. And I said to the waiter, I said, as you can see here, my friend, she's very pregnant and she's been having some complications. Could we, like, go over there in that corner and sit at that table? Because I don't want her to be exposed to a draft or anything. And the waiter said, fine. So we're sitting right next to them, at this particular point. Now, the challenge, and I did this on numerous occasions with another female agent or with a male agent, like I'm on a date with this agent. And what you have to do is you have to carry on a conversation like you know one another, you're a couple, you're good friends, but you're also trying to hear what's going on. And you had Fat Tony and you had Paul Castellano, I think Tommy Bilotti was there, and I can't remember who, there were four of them sitting at that table. And I would say to Corinne, because you can't sit there taking notes for one thing.
Yeah.
And I would say to Corinne, did you just hear Fat Tony say, or did you just hear that? And because we were trying to refresh our memories, because this luncheon, this lasted a couple hours.
Oh my gosh.
And of course, she couldn't drink because she was pregnant. So I was having drinks and trying to stretch this thing out. And then we had to go back downtown. And what we would do is the investigative report that we would write is called a 302. We had to recreate what we heard during that luncheon, and you sign off that, you know, this is what I heard and everything. Now, then, those 302s, those investigative reports, whenever a defendant goes to trial, their defense attorney gets a copy of all those reports so they can compare the defense. So when the commission case, I was the last witness for the government in the commission case, and that 302, all the defense attorneys had, and they were taking me through my, my whole thing that I testified. And then when I was done, the defense did their part, and then the government gets to have a rebuttal, and I was the government's rebuttal. And the reason they made me the rebuttal was, after I gave this, I'm giving this damaging testimony about, of course, Paul Castellano isn't there because he's dead, against Fat Tony. So the defense attorneys, tried to disparage my testimony. And then when I was done, there was dead silence. And Carmine Persico, the boss of the Columbo family, who, I mean, I was sitting in front of him in the courtroom, but I never had talked to him or never had any, worked on anything involving him. He yelled out, "That she's the first FBI agent that has ever told the truth." I mean, I have articles that were in the newspaper the next day about this.
Wow.
Tony actually agrees with him. And I thought, it was like the Twilight Zone, because the courtroom's packed. For one thing, they said, "You're the only FBI," and something like that. In fact, I have it. If I pulled the article out, I could see exactly what Carmine Persico said. And I sat down next to Pat, and Pat turned and whispered in my ear, he said, "I think Tony's losing it." And I just looked at Pat, I said, "I don't know." And then he said, "I think he likes you."
Oh,
My gosh, what
it was
a story.
So silly. It really was kind of a stunning experience. And I know I have drawings that Joe Papen from the New York Daily News did of me in the courtroom, sitting there with all these guys and around me. And, people have always said to me, weren't you afraid? And I said, I was afraid, but you know what I was afraid of? I was afraid that maybe I wasn't doing a good job. Every day I felt that I had to be really, really good at what I did, because otherwise I would be letting my country down, the FBI down, the people I was working with. That was my fear. When I look back on my career now and I think of some of the things that I did, and I thought to myself, oh my God, this could have happened and I could have been shot. This could have happened. When I look back now, I can experience that fear. But when I was working, I didn't have it because I felt this is my job. I got to do it and I've got to do it well or people will be talking about me.
Wow. I was wondering, I had a question floating through my head many minutes ago and we kind of moved on, so it was fine. And it was, I wonder, what you would say, why you were selected. Why did you make it through the grueling process of becoming an agent over other people? And, I think your story is sort of demonstrating why, that you were able to, in very high stakes situations, get the job done, have a casual lunch conversation with a friend and listen and retain and then, regurgitate and communicate very important information, to do that with a level head and then kind of have the delayed reaction, the normal human reaction, like after the fact. I think that's exactly why you're an amazing agent. And they were right. How validating. That is so cool. I'm very impressed.
Well, it's funny because Lynn DeVecchio said to me, and I adored Lynn. He was my supervisor, and he had come down to Quantico and taught my new agents class because he had made members of the mafia as informants. And they warned us. They warned the women about him because he's going to call women bimbos, so you women, you got to get used to it. This is the way it is. So when I got to New York and found that I was being assigned to Lynn DeVecchio, I thought, oh, my God, that's that guy who came down to New York and talked to our class. And as I said in the series, he said to me, it said, I didn't ask for you. I don't want you. Women can't work organized crime. And as long as I'm the supervisor, you will be the only woman on this squad. But I think he quickly realized that he could rely on me, and that's how I got placed with Pat Marshall. I mean, I really feel that's what it is. It's like, whatever you want me to do, Lynn, I'll do it. You call me 3:00 in the morning, I'll be there. And, I mean, we became very good friends, and we're both passionate skiers. We went on some ski trips together, and he was great to work for. But that was his kind of welcome to New York speech.
Yeah, how about it, right? Everybody gets an initiation of some kind, and that was yours. I guess that was just cultural, that was the work culture, I'm sure, in many sectors and industries, but certainly the agency, it sounds like. Do you think the culture has changed? How connected are you to female agents now, and how do you stay connected, or do you?
I don't. I mean, I have just kind of, I bought a second home when I was promoted to FBI headquarters, and I spent 3 years there, and I was promoted to be the supervisor. I was taken over the organized crime program in Philadelphia, which was a very violent group. We had lots of shootings. The older guys were trying to kill the younger guys, and the younger guys were trying to kill the older guys.
Wow.
And I have testified in several mob trials, and I've had death threats. And whenever, of course, everybody I think I put in jail, they're dead now. And when I was working in Philadelphia, I bought a property, a second home in Vermont. And after I retired, I was splitting my time between my house in New Jersey and in Vermont. And it was just, once I sold the New Jersey house and moved full-time into Vermont, I really kind of lost contact with people.
Yeah.
And now I'm living over in New Hampshire. Because most people, nobody really knows here what my background is. I mean, if you ask me, I'll tell you.
Yeah. And you might prefer that even.
Right. Because I've had 3 careers. I mean, I really enjoyed working for Fairfax County Public Schools. IBM is a wonderful company to work for. I had a great experience with the FBI. I mean, once all the other guys got in for our squad. Everybody was, they were fun. I will say, it was kind of one of these things where we were all new, we were all in the same boat, we knew we were working these big cases, but we had fun. We really did. And everybody just kind of pitched in. If anybody asked me to, can you help me tomorrow do this or do that? I mean, I was certainly glad to do it, and they would do it for me. So it was a good atmosphere to work in.
Wow, that's an incredible career. So you retired, and then after Philadelphia, pretty much? Was that your, I mean,
yes,
did work in Mafia just kind of, I mean, I would imagine at a certain point that's very taxing and a high-stress way to live. So was it just time?
No, you know what I did? I really wanted to get back to working white collar. And when I was at FBI headquarters, this opening in Philadelphia came up. And basically, the unit chief said to me, this is yours for the taking because nobody has the background like you. And you would be the first woman in the field serving as a supervisor of an organized crime squad. And I said, well, you know, but I couldn't put in for white-collar positions because of coming out of New York with this big case. They wanted to pigeonhole me into an organized crime situation.
Yeah.
And Jerry said to me, listen, I was an agent in Philadelphia, and every couple years they do a reorganization, and if you make it known that you want to go back to white-collar, you can eventually get back there. And that's after the big case was indicted in Philly, I was able to switch to white collar. And I mean, my whole life kind of changed because people weren't trying to kill our witnesses or our informants. And I was working very closely with the two captains of the Philadelphia Police Department. And, you know, you're getting phone calls in the middle of the night. So-and-so was killed at the Melrose Diner. And you go into white collar and it's like, you're working for a bank now. It's like 9 to 5.
Right.
And so what I decided to do was, you know, you have to, the age for an agent when I came in is you have to retire at 55. And then when Louis Free became the director, he raised it to 57. And when I had bought this house in Vermont, because I'm a skier and I got to know more people like myself that had second homes and everything like that, I had an opportunity to go back to New York whenever a position opened up. But I was so comfortable in Philadelphia, and I really liked living there. I liked the office. I liked the people and everything. I decided this is my last stop. I don't want to move again. I moved 3 times with IBM. Now I'm moving 5 times with the Bureau. I've had enough with the moves. I'm going to stay put.
Yeah.
So that I didn't stay till 57. I retired a few years before when my accountant told me I could afford to.
Good for you. You earned it. Were you surprised when Netflix called and said, we want to feature you in this documentary? How did that transpire?
Well, you know, it was kind of a fluke because Pat Marshall had told me that 60 Minutes was, this is years ago, was looking for me because they wanted to do a program on what transpired in Philadelphia with the mob in Philadelphia.
Okay.
But they couldn't find me. And I was keeping, you know, a low profile. I just want to do my thing in Vermont, ski and do all the things that I do and everything. So the only way they got, I don't know how Netflix got my phone number, but what had happened was I was coming back from Norway and I was flying from Oslo to Amsterdam to Boston. And what happened was my plane, we pulled out onto the tarmac in Oslo, but we sat there for an hour. So that by the time I got to Amsterdam, my plane, I had missed the plane to Boston. So I said, I need to get home. I really need, can you rebook me? And they did. So now I was going to fly to London and take a British Airways flight from London to Boston. So what happened was when I got to Heathrow Airport, for some reason they picked me out as maybe a security risk. I mean, they went through, I have a carry-on bag and a backpack. And this guy was going through all my stuff.
Oh my gosh.
And I had around my neck, I have a necklace that has my 20-year pin has the FBI to turn it over and my name's on it. And I said, you know, not for nothing, I don't want to miss my flight, but I'm a retired FBI agent. You're going through all my stuff.
Good for
and
you.
And of course, he didn't pay any attention to me at all.
Oh.
So what happened was, I finally get home, and maybe 2 days later, I hadn't even unpacked my suitcase. I had the television on, and I have Comcast, and when a phone number comes in, the phone number is, you know, up on the TV, and if there's a, you know, an attendant name with it, and it said, and I glanced up, and it said 44, and I put my head down. I didn't pay any attention to it because I was getting, you know, all these spam calls. And whoever it was, they didn't leave a message. So I thought to myself, wait a minute, 44, that's the country code for right. England.
Yeah.
Maybe something is up with what went through in Heathrow. Did I leave something in Heathrow? And because I hadn't unpacked my stuff. So it rang again. And so I picked up the phone, and I hear this charming guy with a real Irish brogue. I hope you're Charlotte Lang.
Oh,
and I said, yes, I am, because I'm thinking this is somebody like from Heathrow Airport. And he told me he worked for this production company, and he didn't tell me how he had gotten my phone number. And we just kind of talked and chatted. And he said, you know, why don't I call you again? Let's arrange a time where I can, you know, record your conversations. And I ended up, I don't know, I think about 6 hours I talked to him, 2 hours on each particular phone call.
Wow. And was that the director? Was that Sam Hopkinson, or was that a production?
No, that was his name. He's one of the, I saw in the credits, his name is Cathal McIlhenny.
Okay. So he had tracked you down.
He had tracked me down. Now, like I said, the only reason I answered the phone was I saw that when I saw that country code, I thought, oh, this is England calling.
Right. Wow.
And it turned out to be Cathal. And he charmed me. He really charmed me into participating in this.
Well, I'm really, really glad you did. And I really thought it was an excellent 3-part series. I enjoyed seeing New York City. I loved the style of production. And just going back in time, I moved to New York City in 1997. So I was post-Juliana, the Bloomberg years. You know, it was so clean and different. Yeah. So
yes.
I love hearing these stories because I grew up in New Jersey as well. So I, you know, would take day trips into the city from New Jersey in the 80s when I was a child. And that's kind of the gritty New York that's shown in this documentary that I have these kind of fuzzy memories of. So it was really fun to watch. I'd love to ask you, as we close, why do you think people are so interested in mafia stories, right? We have documentaries, but we also have fictional dramatized series like Boardwalk Empire and The Sopranos and Godfather series. You know, what is it about them that is so compelling to us as an audience?
Well, I kind of think it's that, you know, we live in a country that has a gun culture. And what I find so interesting, I go to Europe 2 to 3 times a year. And in fact, I was in Portugal the first 18 days of March. And as you know, after hours, I flew out of Lisbon. They had closed the border at that particular point.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So, and people will say to me, because a lot of times I go by myself because I have interest in history and architecture, and I can be a real bore with another person, and I want to be able to spend as much time as possible. And when I traveled for the Bureau, I was always, almost always traveling by myself. And so I'd take some leave and, you know, stay somewhere. So, and people would say to me, oh, don't you feel frightened? Like you're walking around Paris after midnight and everything like that. I said, no, not at all. Because I know that there's no, but these people, none of them are armed.
Yeah.
Nobody has a weapon that's walking around. And we have, I think it goes back to the whole Wild West and everything. This whole thing of power and guns is something that seems to be endemic in our culture, and people are really drawn to it. I really, really believe it because, I mean, it has this fascinating, grabbing thing for people, and it's really glamorized.
Yeah.
To a great extent, because when I saw Goodfellas, I thought that was the only movie I ever saw that really kind of captured the essence of it. And my agents in Philly couldn't believe that I wasn't watching The Sopranos when it was on live in the 90s. And yeah. I said, you know, I'm Sopranos out.
I had the real deal.
Point.
Yeah.
Because these were my white collar people. It's like, I'm Sopranos out. But then, I don't know, after I didn't watch the Sopranos until after I retired. And I started getting the DVDs from Netflix before I switched to the streaming.
Right.
So that's really when I saw it after I retired. And that captured the essence of it pretty well also. I thought that was very well done.
Yeah, I mean, that show is iconic. So many people love it so much. Yeah, that's a really astute observation. I think you're saying this power and gun culture that seems to be kind of bred into our DNA as Americans, starting with the Wild West and getting what we want, you know, through violence, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so interesting. Charlotte, this was just so amazing to hear your story. I'm really grateful for your time. And, you know, before I let my guests go, I always ask them the same question, which is, what is keeping you up at night right now?
I probably couldn't, it wouldn't be printable for me to tell you what I think of Donald Trump. That's what he's destroying this country.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. That's all you have to say.
I worry for the country. I really, really do.
Yep.
I've had a very privileged life my whole life. I never wanted for anything. And, you know, just by the act of my birth into the right family, I don't have any worries. And I do have a guilt associated with that, because there's so many people I know, hardworking people that I, you know, like my woman who does my hair and woman who does my house and pet sitting, and for no fault of their own, they lost their jobs.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's really sad.
Yeah, times are tough. And, you know, it's not something to feel guilty about. I don't think the privilege, I think about that a lot. But there's, you know, the adage, you know, to whom much is given, much is required. And I think you're someone who goes above and beyond. You know, you've done that through your career, and it sounds like you're continuing to do that. So thank you. Thank you for your service and your amazing contributions to bringing down the commission and for being on Dialogue.
Okay, Rebecca, it was nice talking to you.
Likewise. Take care and be well.